Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Double X is brought to you by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just six simple questions at clubw.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/doublex. And by Bull & Branch, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Go to bullandbranch.com, that's bullandbranch.com, and use the promo code XX. And by The Great Courses Plus, a new video learning service with more than 5,000 lectures. As a member of The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Sign up for a free one-month trial by visiting thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX.
The Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast brings you the latest updates from the campaign trail. The Oscar campaign, that is. Will the voters choose the establishment favorite?
It's Spielberg and it's Disney. You know, it goes down easy enough.
An upstart outsider with a compelling story.
There's a chance you show it and the audience just goes, I do not accept Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace.
Or has the eventual winner not even entered the race yet?
And we were all sitting here this year waiting on these three December movies that no one has seen.
Subscribe to Little Gold Men from Vanity Fair and Panoply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, November 12th, the Goodbye, Dear Prudence edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
I don't have any chatter today.
How's your week going?
I have no chatter. I'm just hot in the booth. That's all I got for you guys today. Okay, let's jump into our three topics then. We'll be all business. First, bathrooms, the next frontier of the culture war. Second, need a mom, a new service that lets you rent out a mom. Why on earth are we living in times when we need a service that lets you rent out a mom? We will discuss. And Slate says goodbye to Dear Prudy. We talk to our own Emily Yaffe about her 10 years as Slate's beloved advice columnist. Okay, let's start with bathrooms. Who doesn't want to talk about bathrooms? Whenever I say bathrooms, I feel like I'm launching into an interior design conversation, but I'm not. Anyway, okay, all over the country, in schools, workplaces, transgender activists are fighting to be able to use the bathroom that comports to their own gender identity, and conservatives are fighting back, claiming the law would, among other things, allow male predators to sneak into women's bathrooms. Maybe we'll start by talking about the Houston non-discrimination law. Mm-hmm. So, June, do you think that this law was defeated because of the bathroom question? Is that incontrovertible?
Absolutely. I mean, it seemed like from the people who I've read who were in Houston, that was what took over the conversation. I mean, so just to, you know, give some background, HERO was a Houston non-discrimination law, which was, well, it was passed and then something was put so that it had to be put to a referendum. And this law covered 15 groups of people, you know, pregnant women, it covered race, LGBT, you know, just the sort of the typical, you know, categories of people who, you know, sometimes require extra protections. And all that the discourse was around the vote was around bathrooms. And it's just, you know, nonsense. And offensive nonsense. And as somebody who writes about LGBTQ issues, we really had a hard time wondering how to cover it because the ads that were run were so mind-bogglingly offensive and wrong and irrelevant and nasty that it was the kind of thing that you don't want to dignify with a response. I mean, we did talk about the ads, but I don't know, you know, on reflection if we covered it enough, but I also just they were nonsense. They were crazy, crazy nonsense.
Well, we should describe the ads a little bit.
All right, let's play a clip of the ad.
Houston's Proposition 1 bathroom ordinance. What does it mean to you? Any man at any time could enter a woman's bathroom simply by claiming to be a woman that day. No one is exempt. Even registered sex offenders could follow women or young girls into the bathroom. And if a business tried to stop them, they'd be fined. Protect women's privacy. Prevent danger. Vote no on the Proposition 1 bathroom ordinance. It goes too far.
So, Jun, the interesting thing to me about that ad is that it actually was not directed at transgender people. That's what was weird. It did not say transgender people are strange and they're totally weird and we can't handle it and they can't be using our bathrooms. It was like a grown man in a lumberjack shirt walking randomly into a bathroom and terrorizing a young girl. That's the disconnect. That's what I couldn't cross. Like, was it actually about fear of the transgender revolution, or was it some totally other thing about bathrooms and just lines we cannot cross, and I'm just holding the line here, like bathrooms are sacred spaces?
Well, that's the thing, because I always try to, you know, give people the courtesy of listening to what they're saying and not, you know, projecting my views onto them or thinking the worst of them. But it was just impossible in this case, because I understand that people have to work through stuff about bathrooms. You're vulnerable in a bathroom. People are still adjusting. I don't really want to excuse this, but people are still adjusting to trans issues and the way that gender is changing. And it does kind of, you know, people have weird thoughts that they kind of need to work through. But this wasn't that. This was completely dog whistle stuff. Because as you say, a dude being in a women's room is nothing to do with trans people. They never say the words transgender. But there was the line that we heard in the ad of something like, you know, but if a man says that he's a woman that day, I mean, just sort right. of nonsensical junk that really has nothing to do with reality, but does, you know, it's an absolute scare tactic. And it's not the first time that this has been used. You know, versions of that ad have been used in Alaska, in other places where this kind of referendum or vote has been held. And it's also, you know, goes back through the years. Similar tactics were used, you know, when the ERA was being considered, anti-ERA people focused on men going in bathrooms. And Outwood had a piece that we published yesterday, a reprint from Notches by an academic called Gillian Frank, about how the history of using bathrooms goes back to segregation era, where whites would say, we're going to have big black men in our white women's bathrooms. I mean, you know, offensive stuff, of course. But and then, you know, even white women would say, we don't want to get VD from black women in bathrooms. I mean, these are horrible, offensive things and crazy things, but it's what people go to the bathroom. I mean, I don't know if
people go to the bathroom. Yeah, but I mean, wait, I understand that it's complete scaremongering on the part of the people who put these ads together. But what is the source of the fear? Like, why bathrooms? Why do people hold the line at bathrooms? Like, I went back and read some of the ERA stuff, because there are some people who think that the ERA was defeated because of the bathroom issue.
Right.
Because somehow people convinced Americans that what would happen when the ERA was passed was that men and women would start using the same bathrooms, which, by the way, I think is a great idea. But anyway, so what is it about the bathroom and the sacred space? Is it that people feel like, okay, we used to try and defend the clubhouses, or we used to have these last bastions, like the way the firemen tried to keep out the women because that's one place where men can just be men, or all men clubs, so that's one place where men can be men. And those have all gone by the wayside. So now you're stuck with the bathroom? I mean, I'm just trying to understand what the fear is and why it locates itself in the bathroom.
Well, I think it's what June said. I think she said you feel vulnerable in the bathroom, and you literally have your pants down. Mm-hmm. You know, something happens, you can't run off very quickly. And I don't think it's logical necessarily. Right. I just think there must be some kind of instinctual human thing where you think, and probably, you know, American discomfort around, you know, genitalia and nudity and like whatever in public. Even though in a women's room in particular, like,
yeah,
it's not like there are urinals that we're all, you know, squatting over.
No.
It's quite private. Yeah, but I think that has to be it, right? Just on a basic human level, you feel like if there were a fight or flight instance, I couldn't do either because I would be exposed.
Well, I think too that guys, and I realize I'm maybe projecting like a worst case scenario, but one of the kind of pieces of discourse that came, another thing that came up in Houston was a guy, and specifically the lieutenant governor of the state, saying that he wanted to protect women, that he would fight to protect women and girls in bathrooms, his kids, his daughter, his granddaughter. And I wonder if there's an element of, I think partly it's men projecting their squickiness, but also like it is gender segregated and women, you know, men can't rush in. Men aren't there to protect their women. Women are alone. And I mean, I think that's why a lot of women like the women's room. But I do think it's again, these weird, like instinctive things that men who are feeling threatened or weird or just sort of not quite comfortable with what's going on around gender project, just they can't be there to defend. It's very condescending to defend their women.
Yeah. But is there any other place that's gender segregated? I mean, maybe that's it. It's the last bastion of gender segregation. It's like the last place where men can be among men and women can be among women and nobody will say anything about it. And that this violates that. I'm not saying that's good. I'm just wondering if that's... There used to be many such places, and now there are none, except the bathroom.
Well, yeah, locker rooms, although that's the kind of the same principle.
Right.
And female reporters, like there's a lot of sports reporters that go into locker rooms. And by the way, locker rooms are being lumped into bathrooms these days. Like you see a lot of these legal fights that are going on are both about bathrooms and locker rooms.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting that it happened this way in Houston in particular. You know, I think people hear Texas and they think, oh, red state, whatever. But Houston is quite liberal.
Very diverse.
It passed this law 2 years ago. It even has a lesbian mayor and has for a couple terms. Mm-hmm. That's what's part of what makes it so shocking was that this particular dog whistle did work in a place like that. You know, it's just a little bit unexpected.
Maybe it's that the line of chaos keeps moving. Initially, it's, you know, gay relationships and then it or sodomy, and then it becomes gay marriage. And now it's transgender activism. So each one of them comes to represent to people just complete chaos. Like if we have this kind of marriage, then the world falls apart. If anybody can walk into it. And now we're at this feels like the last one, you know.
Oh, I bet
now
it's
we're
not.
At a place.
Yeah, maybe it's not. I mean, the Starbucks cup alone makes you realize how much people can gin up when they want to.
Yeah, I guess that's true. All right. Well, last question. Have you guys ever lived in a place, a dorm, been to a restaurant where there are co-ed bathrooms?
I mean, I've been in many gay bars where essentially the bathrooms are de facto co-ed.
And what's your feeling about the co-ed bathroom? When I was in college, I shall admit this on the air if I have never before. Not only was there a co-ed bathroom, there was a co-ed shower.
Wow.
Famously so. In Stanford, what did you guys think of that experience? Did that disturb you? Well, have you ever been in a place where you're actually side by side with a man in a bathroom as opposed to anybody can use the bathroom?
I have to say, I don't know because I think so, but it isn't a thing that has registered as any kind of psychic like occasion for me to, you know, be next to a man urinating. It just doesn't seem that crazy to me.
I think this is an area where people either are just comfortable and don't get what the deal is, like just don't get why people are het up, just don't have any concept of why people are freaking out because it doesn't freak them out. You know, they've been in situations and they just don't care. And then other people just think it's the apocalypse. And I think it's just it's one of those topics where each side doesn't understand the other. Our experience of it, our visceral reaction to it is so different because to me, I just don't get it. And I mean, I really especially don't get the specifics of this because if you say, you know, if you have these tests, although I would love to know how these tests are going to be administered, that, you know, you have to use the bathroom that comports with the gender that you were assigned at birth. It guarantees that you're going to get dudes in the women's room and women in the men's room. I mean, that's what it creates. And so if people are going to get freaked out, surely that would freak them out more. I mean, I don't understand anything about what people are trying to achieve with these kind of rules, except to spread hate. I really don't get it. I just wish that there were, I don't want anybody's sort of comfort to be privileged. I think it's wrong to think that, you know, right now, cisgender women are comfortable, cisgender men are comfortable in their you know, each in their individual bathrooms. It's not already people are uncomfortable. So I just think we should try and do whatever we can to just make as many people as possible comfortable in the bathroom. We shouldn't try to make anyone uncomfortable.
Well, maybe now you've gotten to the heart of it. Like, the idea is to expand people's notions of who they can accept in their private space and who they can be comfortable around. And that's an important thing.
Right.
Okay.
Maybe in the future, humans won't have to go to the bathroom and this will all be solved.
I love
it. Get on it, Silicon Valley.
That'd be awesome. We just have, like, bags that I'm not going to talk anymore. Okay. let's move on to our second topic, Rent-A-Mom. But before we do that, we would like to thank our first sponsor, Club W. June, take it away.
So I hate not feeling like an expert, but I'm really not an expert in wine. So I never know what to buy. I hate wandering around the liquor store or the wine shop looking like a fool. But then I discovered Club W, and now I feel self-actualized and, well, pretty close to expert. So it's super easy. You just go to clubw.com and answer 6 simple questions, and then their algorithm creates a palate profile for you. You don't have to stick with the wines they recommend based on that profile, but it is a nice start. You don't have to just choose on the wine labels, as I usually do. But I have to say, their wine labels are super, super cool. Then they send the wine directly to your door. Club W is actually part of the grape-to-glass wine revolution in that they work directly with vineyards to cut out the middlemen, which saves you money. So with Club W, you get premium wine customized to your taste at a third of what you'd pay at the store. They even have a no-risk, 100% guarantee that you'll love what they send you. And right now, Club W is offering our listeners 50% on your first order when you go to clubw.com/XX. So stop wasting time and money messing around at retail stores and start drinking wine you know you're going to love. Just go to clubw.com/XX, DOUBLEX, and get 50% off your first order. That's clubw.com/XX.
All right, Rent-A-Mom. A Brooklyn woman named Nina Keneally founded a website where for $40 an hour, you can rent a mom, not your own, to help you with things that your idealized perfect mom would help you with in a really nice way, like write a letter to a landlord or figure out what to do with a jerk of a boss. I'm not sure she has any clients. Do you guys know if she has any clients?
She said she has 4 to 6. She just started, but she has a few.
Yeah.
And she's okay. In Bushwick, we should say, which is like ground zero of millennial.
It's where Hannah Horvath goes to party.
Exactly.
So is this even a plausible, before we get to what it means for our society, which I have a lot of ideas about, all of them full of air. No, I do. Is this a plausible business idea?
Yeah, I guess. So to me,
really?
Do you think life coaching is a plausible business idea? Do you think therapy is a plausible business idea? Do you think personal assistants are a plausible business idea? Do you think cleaning ladies or cooks? Do you think those are? I mean, it seems to me what she's offering is some like combination of those services, depending on how you define, you know, a mother's work. And she's a lot cheaper than any of those things that I just named. I think it's $40 an hour. So yeah, I think maybe. She's certainly getting a lot of press.
Well, exactly. I think the press just proves that there is. I mean, as you said, Hannah, she doesn't really have a lot of clients yet. She just sort of put her shingle out, and yet already she's getting a ton of coverage. And I think, to me, that suggests that people think that it's a great concept. And I just don't see why she wouldn't get a ton of clients. It seems like a really super good service.
Well, so I think that she's getting a ton of press because people like to talk about how coddled and dependent on their parents millennials are. But I don't actually think that's why it's a successful kind of thing. Like, I think that, okay, so my big theory about this, why there might be a need for this, is that for millennia, you know, people lived in their sort of extended family, you know, throughout adulthood. And now for the past few generations, people move away to make their fortunes or to just live somewhere cooler or whatever. But, you know, there is the idea that you don't need your parents and you don't need that kind of support once you hit 21 is a very new idea in some ways, you know. And I think it's becoming clear with this generation, which has no shame about sort of wanting their parents, that that's not actually the case. And so that's, I think, maybe what's going on.
I think the name is the problem, that it's a misunderstanding of how it all works right now.
Well, wait, so we should say that the name is Need a Mom.
need a mom. Exactly. I think the way it works now, all that nice little infomercial list that you did at the beginning, Noreen, which mm-hmm. was quite good, actually, you're good at that. The personal trainer, that is all acceptable because all those people are substitute friend, substitute mom. You could even think of therapy that way. Mm-hmm. Like, why wouldn't you be talking to your friends about this? You're talking to somebody that you pay. But they're not actually called substitute friend or substitute mom. That's what I think is wrong with this as a business. That just makes it embarrassing to actually admit that what you're craving is a mom or a friend. It's supposed to be couched in the euphemism of professionalism, such as a life coach. A life coach in the movies is someone who, you know, picks you up when you're crying. It's basically doing what a friend should do.
I don't know, but it actually kind of reminds me of The Intern, the Anne Hathaway movie, where Robert De Niro is an older chap who goes in to intern in her company and essentially acts as her dad. Mm-hmm.
I know, but that was correct. That movie understood the times correctly because what she needed was somebody who was in an officially inferior position. Like that Arlie Hochschild book, which I think is totally brilliant, that outsourced self book, which is constantly mentioned in relationship to this rent-a-mom, because it's this idea that in this moment, we no longer have the time or the space or the kinds of human connections to allow people to naturally help each other in the way they used to. And so what it is largely about relationships between people of the upper class and their help, you know? Nannies, for example, that you have this idealized sense of your nanny as someone who spreads warmth and someone who can substitute and do the things that you can't do because you're so busy.
So, Hannah, I guess I'm confused if you're just saying that this is a branding problem. I mean, it feels like a lot of what you're saying is that rich people used to have servants, whereas poorer people use their families to do these tasks. And now more people potentially, if they can afford it, have access to servants. And she might call her business Need-a-Mom, but she's essentially offering herself as a servant. Is it just a branding problem that you have? Do you think it's just the name of the business? I mean, because it seems kind of viable to me, and it seems in of a piece with a lot of other services, some of which Noreen mentioned earlier. It doesn't seem that crazy to me.
No, I guess I'm saying it makes me sad. That's what I'm saying. What? No, I don't. Maybe it's a viable business service. It just... First of all, I do actually think that part of this problem is not a class problem, but a gender problem. Mm. This is all women's work that isn't getting done anymore. Mm. It does point back to a world in which women used to stitch a society together. And I remember when I lived in New Hampshire once for a few months because I was covering a story there and I moved my family there. And it was amazing to me how hard it was to find hired childcare because it really was not how it worked. Mm. People would just barter childcare. You know, you do one afternoon and somebody else would do one afternoon. It was a small town and your cousin might watch them or one person would do it. You know, the idea that it was so natural to me that I would pay somebody to come in and fill in the hours when I wasn't there, that transaction was so completely organic to my way of living and just completely foreign to other people's way of living. Partly that's a question of finances, but partly it was also a question of how people live. You know, you just those are things that neighbors and friends do for each other, which require people to have a lot more time than we have. We just don't have the time to live that way. You know, you can't. Sometimes it makes me sad if you think of the world as, you know, you don't have the time for really long conversations with your friends, but you do have the time to see a therapist for an hour a week. You know, you don't have the time to be at home, but you hire a babysitter. Can someone break into my apocalyptic view of modern society here and just say like bullshit or something before I start crying?
Bullshit.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Noreen.
But it does make me sad a little bit, too, in part because I think what you might want from a mom is not what she's actually offering. And the thing that is sort of like magical about getting your mother to do these things for you is that it like what she's offering isn't the soup that she made. It's like love, literally love. You know, like my mom came to visit this weekend and she folded my laundry. I think in part because she was like appalled that it had been out of, you know, the washer for 24 hours and it hadn't been folded. But it was just like, everything about it was so sweet, and you don't get that from someone you're paying their services for because it doesn't come with this, you know, incredible history of, you know, a relationship between two people.
I was going to say, these are the views of people who have lovely relationships with their families.
Right.
Because I think for a lot of people, and across class lines, there's an element of feeling so stressed out about having to maintain those informal relationships that you of the kind that you were talking about having in New Hampshire, that if it was possible and if they had the money to just pay someone to do it, they would feel so much less stress, and in many ways their lives would be better. I think there's a lot of romanticization of that kind of informal economy that, even though there are many, many, many things wrong with our current sort of version of the sharing economy, I just feel more comfortable when money is changing hands, because it just feels like actually this informal economy is a way of not really confronting the fact that we're exploiting a lot of people because of their roles. Maybe not our moms most of the time, but the kind of extended version of this.
Hmm. Well, that is a view in the Arlie Hochschild book. That's the final twist that it makes, that there are some people in the servant class who prefer this. Like, let's say they take care of a rich elderly woman. I remember one guy like that in the book. And it was a way for him to remake in this, you know, tidy, formal form, his very shitty relationship with his own mother. So he thought this was kind of a nice relationship that he had, and it had boundaries, and it allowed him to replay some of the issues, but in a nicer way. Maybe it is the uncanny valley problem. Like, Noreen, when you mentioned, you know, bringing your stuff to the laundry, but that's completely impersonal, you know, and your own mom is maybe too sticky for that kind of thing. But then you get this in-between space where you call someone a mom and they do all these mom-like things, but they're not a mom. Don't they do this in Japan? I feel like every year there comes a story out of Japan that's, oh, rent a grandpa or rent a child for your family party if you don't have a child of your own. And
oh,
somehow
my God,
it makes sense in Japanese society. But in America, it feels a little icky.
We'll be using robots soon anyway, so it's okay.
Robot mom. I'll take a robot mom to a colonoscopy. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to our third topic, which is talking to Emily Yaffe. But before we do that, we would like to thank Bowl and Branch, our loyal sponsor. We spend a third of our life in bed. Some of us spend more than a third of our life in bed, sleeping on sheets, so they might as well be excellent ones. What we love about this company is its very slate-pitchy ethos. As I've said before, thread count, apparently a marketing myth. Egyptian cotton, it does not really exist. Also, the expensive prices we pay for sheets, unnecessary. So what Bowl and Branch does is cut out the middleman and take away department store markups, which are like 800%. So you can buy amazing luxury sheets at half the price. They only sell online, bowlandbranch.com. You can try them risk-free for 30 nights. They'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping if you go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX, bowlandbranch.com, XX. Okay. For our next topic, we're going to talk to Slate's beloved Emily Yaffe, who has been Slate's Dear Prudy for about a decade. Emily Yaffe is moving on to The Atlantic. The column is going to be taken over by the great Mallory Ortberg, but we'll talk to Emily about her best moments as the advice columnist. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Is that Hannah?
It is. It is. It is. So I have one question. Have you already shed the Dear Prudy skin? I don't know what that would mean, but, you know, I always imagine, and I imagine lots of your readers do too, that you walk around the earth just kind of dispensing advice like fairy dust in your head to everybody you meet, and now you shed that layer, or it doesn't work like that?
Have you got a problem for me, Hannah? If so, I don't care. I hope, and please don't get testimony from my friends, that I, in my normal life, I didn't go around being prudy, because how ultra obnoxious would that be? So, you know, obviously I don't always have the answer. Ask anyone who knows me about, and then how I conduct my own life. Obviously, I don't have all the answers. So there is kind of a divide. There's a persona and then there's me.
All right. Right. But you answered so many letters and they were always streaming through your life. It's like living with characters who have issues and need you in a certain way. It must change your internal architecture somehow.
I'll tell you what, one thing I won't miss, and doing this job was such a great honor, and I really felt an obligation to people, and you know, I was moved that they trusted me. But when I would come back from vacation, there would be hundreds of letters, and you know, I'd have to sit and go through hundreds of letters. And the overwhelming amount of pain that I would read was, that was hard. Obviously, not as hard for me as the people experiencing the pain. But yes, that sense of people out there often writing late at night to a stranger saying, can you help me? That's a really hard part of this job.
Emily, I'm curious. I think one instinct that a lot of journalists share is that they tend to be more judgmental people, like just snap judgments are made all the time. Do you think this made you more judgmental or less so?
Well, this job requires snap judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You have to dispense them. You have to at least sound certain, or else it doesn't work as a form. So I tried to think I developed a good ability to read between the lines and sort of boil down things based on a small amount of information. But who knows? You know, I gave my opinion and moved on. I actually, when I was starting this job and I was kind of feeling, gee, the burden of this, and I was talking to a friend and she said, have you ever been to a psychic? And I said, yeah. She said, okay, so why go to a psychic and not a therapist? And I said, because I want, like, the real answer. And she said, that's the thing. You go to the psychic because you want someone to say, yes, no, do this, don't do this. And you just want that. And she said, you know, that's what this is. Sometimes you don't want a long discussion about your mother. You just want someone to give you snap judgment. So actually, that made me feel better.
Yeah, totally.
Emily, do you think that you, Emily Yoffe, rather than you, the character, Dear Prudence, have been changed or affected in any kind of lasting way by dealing with all these thousands of letters over the last 10 years?
Oh, absolutely. I feel my daughter benefited from this because I had to refer to good parenting sources on dealing with conflict, and I climbed down a lot off things that were, you know, I could feel myself getting very angry at this teenager, and being Prudence really helped me see, man, this isn't worth it. And, you know as a parent when you start losing it, you've lost. So I think she would say that she benefited that I was Prudence. And I'm not naturally the nicest person in the world. And just my sister would always say to me when I'd be complaining or bitching about stuff, she would say, well, what would Prudence say? And I'd say, I don't care what Prudy would say. I want to be furious. She'd say, come on. Just answer it as Prudy. And actually, okay, Prudence would say, and, you know, that usually would be better advice than what Emily would say.
If you were writing, like, a self-help book, like a Dear Prudence self-help book, and you had to come up with, like, one piece of advice for the intro chapter that would get blurbed everywhere, what is the single best advice Dear Prudence has to offer? Like a general life maxim. Is there one?
Think about whether this is something you can just let go of.
Huh.
Now, you don't want to be a doormat, but a lot of the things that cause that kind of intense flare, it is the everyday kind of, I wasn't appropriately acknowledged, or what did that look mean, or what did that word mean, and it's so human and instinctive, and you feel that flare, and most of it's not worth getting into or holding on to.
What about lessons about marriage? I've always been curious about that, because you get such interesting letters about relationships, or maybe just say long-term relationships rather than marriage. Is there a problem you see over and over again and a simple solution?
Less porn. Or maybe more fun. I don't know. Okay, there are two parts of it. Porn is not cheating.
Uh-huh.
So that's... Now, if your husband is addicted to porn and he's not having sex with you and he treats you like you're some Bulgarian porn star, that's a problem. But just finding out your husband looks at porn, that's the default, people looking at porn.
What if I want to be treated like a Bulgarian porn star?
So that's one thing. Again, the let it go is so, having a bad memory is very important for the sake of marriage. Huh. Yes, yes.
That's a good first chapter title, have a bad memory.
Yeah.
Is there any letter that you really wanted to answer but couldn't figure out how to answer? You couldn't come up with the psychic certainty about?
Hannah, that's my secret. I didn't answer them. There are so, yes, every week there would be letters. Huh, that's interesting. It wasn't so much this is beyond the capacity of an advice columnist, but it's just I'm having a hard time sort of figuring out who's at fault here or whatever. As a general category, I mean, you can imagine, and I did deal with some of these letters. The absolute hardest letters were people who had lost children. I'm choking up thinking of some of them. You know, they're just so raw and painful, and I did run some. And there's nothing you can say except this terrible thing happened. So those were the hardest.
And is there any culture change you could track over 10 years? Like 10 years ago, I got so many more letters like this, and now I get more letters like this. Like something that would tell us something about our inner psyche that's shifted in a decade.
Oh, absolutely. letters from the LGBT community. Complete shift. When I started, they were almost all, I don't want to go to Christmas because of my bigoted uncle. Or I work with someone who, I'm in the closet, and I work with someone who's always making anti-gay remarks. What do I do? Over the almost 10 years, I almost never get those anymore. I still get quite a few letters from gay and lesbian people, but they're just questions from people who happen to have, you know, pronouns. They're both guys, they're both women. I mean, it's an absolutely remarkable change.
You mean, so they just ask you, you know, any old relationship question? Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, actually. Relationship question, work question, or, you know, my boyfriend and I, blah, blah, blah. And I can see, you know, most people use their actual email. So I can see his name is Michael. He says, my boyfriend and I. It has nothing to do with being gay. It's just he happens to be a gay person writing to me.
Emily, are there things that you regret, pieces of advice that you've given or trouble that you've gotten into? Are there things that you wish you could do from the last 10 years?
You mean what large percentage of the questions? Like, let me retract that. Okay. Most of the questions are a judgment call. And they're just a moment in time. They're a snapshot. How do I know, you know, I say, don't confess the infidelity. Was that the right or wrong answer? The person. Fortunately, no one's legally obligated to take my answers. So, you know, a lot of those are just wrestling. When I objectively blew it, I always put an update or, you know, just said, that was really, really bad advice. I retract that. Fortunately, that was rare. But as I say, it's, you know, that's kind of a judgment call. I remember the question, do you tell children they were not actually sired by the person they think of as dad? This is one thing I found from doing this column. Some percentage, it may be small, of people walking around, the person they think is their biological father actually is. the number of people who wrote in, you know, the woman confessing, actually, my son is the product of an affair, or the number of people who aren't fathered by the person they thought they were is incredible. So grappling with, do you tell a child being brought up by a mother and father that, hey, mom had an affair and dad's not your dad? I, a couple of times, said don't tell, and people really came down on me, and I understand it, and, you know, by the end, I was like, okay, you gotta tell. But I promise you, there are a lot of people who, this, you know, people say the secret always comes out. It does not. I'm absolutely sure there are a lot of people who go to their graves having never told the kid the secret, and the kid goes to his or her grave not knowing this.
Emily, we have to wrap up, but I wondered, do you have one piece of advice for your successor, who is the fantastic writer Mallory Ortberg?
Yes. Mallory has great wit, and this column requires that, and I'm so glad someone with this distinctive voice who's, you know, she could do stand-up. So bring that to the column and then take it really, really seriously.
Cool. Excellent. Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us. We will miss you, and we look forward to what you write at The Atlantic.
Thank you so much. This has just been so much fun, and let's all stay in touch.
Okay. Now let's move on to our recommendations, but before we do that, we'd like to thank our third sponsor, Great Courses. We are big fans of the Great Courses because you can learn so many things at your own pace just for the pleasure of it. So we're excited about something new from Great Courses, the Great Courses Plus video learning service, where you have unlimited access to thousands of subjects, nearly 5,000 lectures in subjects like history, science, photography, and cooking taught by award-winning professors. With Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many lectures as you want at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. My favorite remains the photography course, which I remember so many tips from. Our listeners get a new introductory offer to try the Great Courses Plus free for a month. They're normally priced at $200 to $300 each, but you can get unlimited access completely free for 1 month. Sign up now. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX. Okay, recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
Well, I have just begun watching Aziz Ansari's Netflix series, and I'm into it.
Master of None.
Master of None. Streaming on Netflix, I think, the whole season, although I've only watched, I think, maybe three episodes. Have you?
Can you give me some tidbits? Because I'm like, every night I mean to watch, and then I just, like, I didn't get around to it, and tonight is my night.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. I think it's kind of, I think Willa Paskin wrote a review of it as, like, the great rom-com of our moment. And it might be that, but I also think it's really interesting social commentary. Like, I think that's what Aziz Ansari wants to do. Mm-hmm. He's not a conservative in the sort of political sense, but I think he is interested in the ways that technology has frayed us all. So it's a lot about, like, texting, as his book was, the way texting affects it. It's kind of fun for me because his character obviously lives in Williamsburg, where I used to live, and so it's all these places that I recognize, and he's, like, of my micro generation. But yeah, it's funny. It's not as, like, laugh out loud funny as you might expect, but it is earnest in a certain way, in a way that I enjoyed.
Yeah, and I watched all 10 episodes this weekend, and it is really interesting because it feels like it's about seven different shows. It's the same set of characters who you actually get to know and like and become interested in. It's kind of starts on a lot of stuff that's very much from his book, which we talked about, but then it does become, by the end, really pretty much a rom-com. There's a lot of really interesting commentary on race in acting and entertainment, and it almost seems to be kind of in conversation with, like, Broad City and Girls and Odd Mom Out, even in a weird way.
And Hannah, the second episode is all about immigrant parents, so you might enjoy it.
Oh, I love stuff about immigrants. My favorite subject. Okay, well, I am reading Fates and Furies, the Lauren Groff novel, and absolutely loving it. I also loved her last novel, Arcadia. Fates and Furies is about a marriage. It's told from two different perspectives. I'm actually only halfway through, so I don't have the wife's view yet. But it's written in such a beautiful, sometimes like dreamlike, almost incomplete way that really just lets you sink into the emotional moment more than just track what's actually going on. But I just think it's a fabulous novel. Loving it. June.
So I don't really watch sports anymore, but I still really enjoy sports commentary. I like listening to sports radio. I like watching sports discussion shows, but I don't really have a lot of time for them. But I discovered recently that you can listen to the ESPN show His and Hers as a podcast. Now, His and Hers is, as the title suggests, a very gendered sports show. It's Michael Smith and Jemele Hill, who have known each other for a while, and they talk as friends and as two African-American journalists who are now kind of at the top of their professions. So the show is available as a podcast, but they also do original discussions that they make available as podcasts. So recently, earlier this week, they had a conversation about what was going on at Mizzou, which started at the University of Missouri, which started as a sports story and became a story about race and about colleges and about protest. And they got so real about, you know, having whether when or where they'd been called the N-word, where they confronted racism in their careers, kind of talking about their careers and having, you know, gone to all black high schools. And even if you're not that interested in sports, I think it's just a really interesting, smart conversation between friends, and it's called His and Hers.
Sounds excellent. So that's it for today. Thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the whole roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. You can find out more about this show at our show page, slate.com/XX, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to start a discussion about this show or recommend new topics. Email is XXGabFest@slate.com, or subscribe to us on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. Thank you. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks.